Democracy Now! Is a listener-supported grassroots global news hour. You make it possible when you donate at democracynow.org. Thank you so much. From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
There's no line between legislators and bankers. And beyond the millions of dollars that they are getting to run their campaigns and to stay in office or to get elected into office and so forth, there's also all the sort of additional value that is received by the fact that J.P. Morgan Chase actually is giving them money. Because if one bank is giving them money, it's not the only bank giving them money. It's the entire industry.
All the president's bankers, the hidden alliances that drive American power. We'll speak with financial journalist Nomi Prins about the 100-year history of collusion between Washington and Wall Street. Then shining a light on the NSA's black budget. We'll go to Capitol Hill to speak with Vermont Congressmember Peter Welch. He's sponsoring a bill to force the president to include the total dollar amount requested for each of the 16 intelligence agencies. Then a federal judge has dismissed a lawsuit challenging the U.S. government's killing of three Americans in Yemen in drone strikes. We'll get reaction from attorney Maria LaHood.
The Constitution clearly applies to al-Awlaki because he is a U.S. citizen, so he is guaranteed due process. If the U.S. government can kill a U.S. citizen in Yemen, that not only expands the global war, but it also means that a U.S. citizen could be killed anywhere by our government.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Authorities in Ukraine say they've regained control of a regional administration building in the city of Kharkov, one of three eastern cities where pro-Russian demonstrators have seized government sites. In the city of Donetsk, authorities remain in a standoff with demonstrators who've declared an independent republic and urge Russian President Vladimir Putin to send in the troops. Donetsk is the hometown of ousted Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych. On Monday, State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki said Secretary of State John Kerry spoke to his Russian counterpart by phone.
He called on Russia to publicly disavow the activities of separatists, saboteurs, and provocateurs, calling for de-escalation and dialogue, and called on all parties to refrain from agitation in Ukraine. He made clear that any further Russian efforts to destabilize Ukraine will incur further costs for Russia. And the ministers also discussed convening direct talks within the next 10 days between Ukraine, Russia, the United States, and the EU to try to de-escalate the tensions.
Russia's foreign ministry claims Ukraine's forces in the east have been joined by both right-wing nationalists and U.S. mercenaries from the private military firm Greystone. Greystone's affiliated with the private security firm Academy, formerly known as Blackwater, which has previously denied accusations its staff are working in Ukraine. In Afghanistan, a roadside bomb killed at least 15 people Monday. The victims were civilians whose vehicles had been diverted from the main road after a previous attack targeting NATO troops. The attacks came 2 days after Afghanistan's presidential election, the final results of which are not expected for weeks. An outbreak of polio in Syria has officially spread into neighboring Iraq amidst warnings scores of Iraqi children could be at risk. The disease was confirmed in a six-month-old baby boy in Baghdad last month, marking Iraq's first case in 14 years. Polio has paralyzed dozens of children in Syria, where it emerged last year for the first time since 1999. The virus has been traced to Pakistan, where anti-polio workers have come under frequent attack after a polio vaccination campaign was used by the CIA to help find Osama bin Laden. In Egypt, an appeals court has upheld the 3-year prison terms of three top political activists accused of violating an anti-protest law. Ahmed Maher, Ahmed Duma and Mohammed Adel are sentenced in December under a new law that effectively bans public protests by requiring 7 different permits. The activists helped lead the uprising that ousted Hosni Mubarak in 2011. Ahmed Duma's health is said to be deteriorating in prison. His brother Mohammed said the fight extends beyond opposition to individuals such as interim President Adli Mansour and the presidential favorite, the former military chief Abdel Fattah al-Sisi.
Our battle has never been against a specific regime, as we previously thought. Whether the Muslim Brotherhood, military, Mubarak, or Adli Mansour and Sisi, our battle is against an oppressive state. All it cares about is suppressing and jailing opinions. All it knows is tyranny. All it cares about is corruption and oppression. Its role is to suppress and kill the revolution. Its only concern is its interests.
Around the world Monday, people took to social media to show support for four Al Jazeera journalists detained in Egypt for months. The Global Day of Action marked 100 days since the arrest of Peter Gresty, Mohamed Fahmy and Bahar Mohamed. A fourth journalist, Abdullah El-Sami, has been held for more than 7 months and is on hunger strike since January 23rd. Rwanda has begun a week of mourning to mark the 20th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide, when 800,000 people were killed over the course of 100 days. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon spoke at Monday's commemoration in Kigali.
On my first visit to the Kisoji Memorial, I heard and felt the silence of death. The silence of all those lost and the silence of the international community in your hours of greatest need. Many United Nations personnel and others showed remarkable bravery, but we could have done much more. We should have done much more.
For our full coverage of the 20th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide, including the Clinton administration's refusal to call it a genocide at the time, you can go to democracynow.org. The Senate has voted to restore aid for 2.8 million Americans who have been unemployed for more than 26 weeks. Benefits for the long-term unemployed expired in December. The bill now heads to the Republican-led House, where Speaker John Boehner has indicated it's unlikely to get a vote. The death toll from a mudslide northeast of Seattle, Washington, has risen to 33. The local medical examiner's office said three people still remain unidentified, while 10 remain missing 2 weeks after disaster struck the town of Oso. Memorial services for the victims began over the weekend. New details have emerged about last week's shooting at the Fort Hood military base in Texas. Army Specialist Ivan Lopez fatally shot three people and injured 16 before killing himself. Officials have confirmed the shooting took place after an argument over the processing of Lopez's request for a leave of absence to tend to family matters. They say the entire rampage lasted about 8 minutes. In a victory for LGBT rights, the U.S. Supreme Court has rejected an appeal by a New Mexico photography studio that refused to document a same-sex commitment ceremony. The decision leaves in place a ruling by the New Mexico Supreme Court, which found the company violated state anti-discrimination law, quote, in the same way as if it had refused to photograph a wedding between people of different races. Senate Democrats are criticizing former CIA Director Michael Hayden for describing Senate Intelligence Committee Chair Dianne Feinstein as emotional over her efforts to declassify a Senate probe on CIA torture and rendition. Hayden made the remarks on Fox News on Sunday.
That sentence, that motivation for the report, Chris, may show deep emotional feeling on the part of the senator, but I don't think it leads you to an objective report.
In response to Hayden's comments, Democratic Senator Mark Udall of Colorado said, quote, I highly doubt he would call a male chairman too emotional, and to do so with Chairwoman Feinstein is unacceptable. Hayden's comments are the latest chapter in a spat over the Senate torture report between the CIA and Feinstein, who's openly accused the CIA of spying on Senate staffers. Feinstein herself dismissed Hayden's remarks as, quote, absolute nonsense. In the Philippines, the Supreme Court has upheld key parts of a government plan to provide universal access to contraception. The reproductive health law was signed in 2012 after pressure from the Catholic Church blocked its passage for 13 years. It requires government health centers to provide free access to condoms and birth control, mandates sex education in public schools, and requires health workers to care for people suffering from the effects of illegal abortions. A Mississippi judge has dismissed a murder charge against a young African-American woman who faced life in prison after giving birth to a stillborn baby. Rennie Gibbs was 16 years old when she was indicted for, quote, depraved heart murder, accused of willfully causing her baby's death by smoking crack cocaine. A medical examiner had ruled the death a homicide after finding traces of a cocaine byproduct in the baby's system. But experts later concluded the death was likely caused by an umbilical cord wrapped around the baby's neck. Despite those reports, a Mississippi prosecutor has suggested the state will now move to reindict Gibbs for manslaughter. In a statement, Lynn Paltrow, head of National Advocates for Pregnant Women and a co-counsel on the case, said, quote, the biggest threats to life, born and unborn, do not come from mothers, but rather from poverty, barriers to health care, persistent racism, environmental hazards, and prosecutions like this one, Paltrow said. And Peter Matheson's final novel comes out today, 3 days after the celebrated author and naturalist died of leukemia at the age of 86. In his 20s, Peter Matheson helped found the Paris Review, which he later admitted using as a cover for spying on Americans in France as a CIA agent. He wrote more than 30 books, including In the Spirit of Crazy Horse, about imprisoned Native American leader Leonard Peltier. The book prompted lawsuits from an FBI agent and a former governor of South Dakota, both of which were later dismissed. Peter Matheson is the only writer to win the National Book Award for both fiction and nonfiction. His last novel out today is called In Paradise. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Aaron Maté. Welcome to our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. Well, if you go by the balance sheet, the last 4 years have been a time of economic growth in the United States. Corporate profits and stock prices have mostly recovered and, in many cases, surpassed their levels from before the financial crisis. On Wall Street, bonuses are now the highest they've been since before the 2008 crash. Just last year, payouts increased 15% to $26.7 billion. That's enough money to more than double the pay of every minimum wage worker in the country. That's because, for most Americans, the recovery has been elusive. Inequality is now at its highest point since 1928, and wages for lower-income Americans are stagnant.
Well, we now turn to a new history that explains how this disparity has come to be. In her new book, All the President's Bankers, The Hidden Alliances That Drive American Power, financial journalist Naomi Prinz traces the 100-year history of collusion between Washington and Wall Street. Prinz reveals how a small number of bankers have played critical roles in shaping a century's worth of financial, foreign and domestic policy in the United States. These relationships have influenced events from the creation of the Federal Reserve, the response to the Great Depression, and the founding of the IMF and the World Bank. For a good part of the 20th century, bankers and presidents presided over a financial system that was relatively stable. But as Wall Street grew increasingly outside of Washington's control, financial speculation has exploded, leading to the financial crisis of 2008. And even though the economy may now be on the mend, Naomi Prinz ends her book with a stark warning, writing, "Either we break the alliances or they will break us." Naomi Prinz is a former managing director at Bear Stearns and Goldman Sachs and previously an analyst at Lehman Brothers and Chase Manhattan Bank, now a senior fellow at Demos and author of this new book, All the President's Bankers. Naomi, it's great to have you with us. Talk about the inspiration for the book.
Well, actually, we were on the show a few years ago. I was talking about a novel I had written, a historical novel on the 1929 crash called Black Tuesday. And what had happened as one of the segments in that book was that six bankers had gotten together at the behest of the acting chairman of the Morgan Bank, who was Thomas Lamont at the time, and they had so been afraid of losing all of the money and all of their reputations and their institutions at the time that they got together and decided to pool their own money to save the markets. Stark difference from what happened more recently, which was that the Federal Reserve, Treasury Department, and everyone else from the government decided to work with them to save themselves. But the impetus for the book really came from those big six bankers. We still have big six bankers today. And I looked into the relationships that they had with all of the presidents going forward and backward from that time to come up with this All the President's Bankers analysis.
Talk about who they were and the companies they represented and go back.
Yeah, so in 1929, the men that sat in the room at Morgan was Tom Lamont, who was the acting chair of Morgan, as I mentioned, Charles Mitchell, who was the chairman of National City Bank, which has now grown into Citigroup, Al Wiggin, who was the head of the Chase Bank, which is now part of the Chase, J.P. Morgan Chase constellation, and a couple of other bankers. And they basically have morphed into some of the six banks we have today. The ones that were absent were Goldman Sachs and Bank of America, but they came in through other avenues and personal connections to bankers from FDR and forward since that time. And what I did was I went backwards from the crash in 1929 and noticed that J.P. Morgan, who is arguably, not even arguably, who is the most powerful banker this country has ever known and the most powerful political financial actor. He died 100 years ago, but his legacy, his family, what he created and the constellation of relationships between him and, at the time, Teddy Roosevelt, as far back as 1907, through Jamie Dimon's relationship with Obama more recently, has been a very apparent apparatus in the connection of politics and finance, which I believe has no separation line.
Well, on that absent separation line, talk about the creation of the Federal Reserve.
So this panic in 1907 happened. Teddy Roosevelt, who historically we know as the great trust buster, didn't bust banks. Busted a lot of other companies, a lot of other industries, not banks. And the reason for that was he truly believed, and he says this in documents and memoirs that I looked through, he truly believed that J.P. Morgan, the man, and his bank and his friends could save New York and the country from a greater catastrophe after the panic of 1907. And J.P. Morgan got together with a bunch of people at the Hotel Manhattan at midnight, didn't have the president there, didn't have the Treasury Secretary there, told them later what they would do. And what they would do is save their friends. And that's what they did, with some of their own money, a little bit of Treasury money, save their friends, save the Trust Company of America, because they had interest in that. They decided they didn't want to really have that kind of scare again. So they continued to push for this idea of a central bank, which was the Federal Reserve. They had help with a senator, Nelson Aldrich, who was head of the Senate Finance Committee at the time, after a year or so after that, under President Taft. Nelson Aldrich took a group of bankers in 1910 to Jekyll Island. He almost didn't make that meeting. He got hit by a trolley car up on Madison Avenue, was convalescing with his son, Winthrop Aldrich, who became the head of Chase later, and took a bunch of representatives from J.P. Morgan's bank. J.P. Morgan was not there, and that's power. You don't go. You send your lieutenants to Jekyll Island for 10 days. They hunted, they shot pheasants, they did all sorts of things, but they came out also with the impetus for the Federal Reserve. On the way back, the train back to Washington, Nelson Aldrich had to present this plan. He was still convalescing. Two bankers that came from that meeting went in his place to Washington to put up the plans. Now, it wasn't passed under Taft. It was passed under the Democrat president, Woodrow Wilson. But a lot of those same individuals were friends with Woodrow Wilson as well into his presidency and, in fact, helped campaign and raise money for his presidency. And it was and the Federal Reserve Act was ultimately passed in the end of 1913 under Wilson.
What were the most famous, or not as well known, but you uncovered them, bromances between top bankers and presidents?
Right. So this one of them was Tom Lamont, who I mentioned was around in 1929. But he started his life moving up the chain of Morgan after the panic in 1907 in things called the Peugeot trials, which were in 1912, which at the time looked at what bankers had done to cause the panic of 1907. He was a young lawyer at the time. He had gone to Harvard with FDR. But as a young man, he was also hanging out, living in the house of FDR up on 65th Street, renting it for several years while FDR was the assistant Navy secretary under Woodrow Wilson. They chose Tom Lamont to go with Wilson to France for 6 weeks. Wilson was in France. It was the longest time a U.S. president was outside of U.S. soil and the first time a U.S. president was outside of U.S. soil. But the banker that was by his side was Tom Lamont. He was a Republican. He went across his party lines to come back with Woodrow Wilson to fight for the League of Nations to try to preserve peace after World War I, which was defeated. But Tom Lamont and Woodrow Wilson developed this relationship, and their letters are crazy. They're like so full of gratuity and love and just, you know, thank you for being there by my side, and I couldn't have done it without you. Because when Woodrow Wilson then got a stroke and it was difficult for him to go around the country to, after the war, fight for the League of Nations, which the Senate didn't want to pass and ultimately did not pass, Tom Lamont took it up in his newspapers that he owned, the Saturday Review, went before, you know, back doors in terms of the senators that he knew and really tried to push it. And the two of them really worked very closely together and had this romance. And, of course, Woodrow Wilson ultimately did die from complications of those strokes.
If we look back on the Great Depression, it's understood that Wall Street was hostile in many ways to the New Deal. But how did Wall Street work with Roosevelt, and why?
So one of the men, Winthrop Aldrich, who I mentioned before, was the son of the founder of the Fed, one of the founders of the Fed, Senator Nelson Aldrich, was also friends with the Roosevelts. He was friends with FDR. And he also knew from a business perspective, he wanted to outdo the Morgans. So he said, you know, Chase has some trading, some speculation that went miles wrong in the crash of 1929. And he believed that for the stability of the economy and for his bank going forward, so he could sort of walk and chew gum at the same time, see the public interest as well as his bank's interest, worked with FDR to pass the Glass-Steagall Act, which separated the speculative activities from the depositors that had their money entrusted to banks at the time, including at Chase. And actually, Carter Glass, whose name is on that act, wanted a slightly weaker version of the act than Winthrop Aldrich pushed inside of Washington with the alliance of FDR. So that was a very, very different time. You cannot imagine today Jamie Dimon pushing with President Obama to separate his bank in such a way that it decreases its risk to depositors and taxpayers. It's just unimaginable.
Well, talk about the relationship today. You have said that the relationships between bankers and presidents, those in power, is more dangerous today. And maybe you can use the example of J.P. Morgan Chase, Jamie Dimon's relationship. I mean, it's hard to forget him going before a Senate committee when there's so many questions, even the question of would he be criminally prosecuted, and they're on bended knee to him. And you're just looking at senators one by one. And though the TV corporate networks weren't showing it, you know, the cha-chung, how many millions his bank and him were responsible for giving to these senators, Republican and Democrat?
Well, yeah, and I actually remember being up at 4:30 or so in the morning in L.A. talking about Jamie Dimon bold-faced lying to those committees and then, yeah, and then turning over and saying, well, can you give us advice about the economy? It was kind of ridiculous. This was after the London whale trade, after they lost billions of dollars in money that should have been separated from speculation to begin with. So the relationship is much more dangerous also because those big six banks today, again, slight derivations of the big six banks in 1929, but today own 85% of deposits of all the commercial banks, 84% of assets of all the commercial banks, and control 96% of all of the derivatives that financial institutions that are backed by the government utilize today, and 45% of the world's derivatives. Six banks control so much capital and have so much power as to the laws around that capital and the administration. And this started in Reagan through Bush, through Clinton, into Obama. This is not new, but the reaction of the administrations has been to allow this to happen, to allow the concentration of this capital, of this power, to do nothing in the face of the financial crisis of 2008, which I believe is still ongoing, just in a different manifestation, because this risk still exists and because these numbers are worse than they were before the crisis of 2008.
JFK, his relationship with the bankers.
JFK was interesting. Of course, he wasn't
president
for a long time.
Of a bank.
I think one of the things I look at in the book is sort of the pedigree and the social stature of a lot of the bankers and presidents, and also their connections. In the case of JFK, for example, he was in London in 1938 because his father, Joe Kennedy, who was the first appointed SEC head under FDR, because they were friends, because he helped with that campaign, met David Rockefeller in London at this gala coming out party for JFK's sister, Kathleen. And David Rockefeller even briefly dated his sister, Kathleen. Kathleen. So there was just so many social ties as well. But the other side of JFK is that his personal relationship, despite the social background, was a little more stilted. He just came off as a little more trying to do his own thing. So even when, and because he had this longstanding relationship with David Rockefeller, they started to really diffuse. Rockefeller started saying disparaging things in public, in particular this really interesting Life magazine article that came out in 1962 that were going against what JFK was trying to do. JFK, for example, in Latin America was trying to allow those countries to be more independent, to not have more private debt imposed upon them, which is what Rockefeller and the other bankers wanted to do at the time as a new source of making money. And this really disturbed Rockefeller in particular, who was trying to expand the bank into those areas. So on the one side, they had a very strong social connection, and on the other side, JFK really tried to go about in a way to make external countries a little bit more independent financially from the United States, whereas that was the point where things started going in separate directions, and Rockefeller and Walter Wriston, who ran National City Bank at the time, really wanted to dump them with debt and to privatize and do all sorts of things that have gotten worse since then.
So what happens since the 1970s? You have, at least for the bulk of the 20th century, banks and the government working together. Since the 70s, though, Wall Street kind of goes rogue. So what accounts for this shift, and how do we fix it now?
Yeah, so a little bit started when they found they could do a foreign policy that was separate from U.S. policy, that was an expansion of banks in a foreign capacity. And then LBJ tried to rein some of that back. He had some friends that he basically said, you know, you guys, I know you want to do your own thing, but I have a great society vision coming on board, so you need to back me. So there's a little still quid pro quo there. By the time the 70s came along, with Nixon, who had less personal relationships and also ultimately took the country off the gold standard, which he did because the bankers pushed him to do it, because at this point they wanted two things. They saw that there was Middle East oil, and they could go in there and start to forge relationships and branches in the Middle East and utilize those petrodollars to recycle. It was a huge thing in the early 70s into Latin America and other countries. So they started operating more internationally and independently of their connections to the president. And the minute they discovered all that money and they dumped all of that debt into the third world, that manifested in a huge third world debt crisis in the 1980s. And that was a first very large instance of a bailout. There was a small bailout for Penn Central, which was a railroad constellation in the 70s. But in the 80s, under Reagan and under Bush, the idea of bailing out the banks, who had now refunneled all of this debt into Latin America, was a very epic decision. And it was one in which the bankers gave nothing back to the government. They were like, we're going to use your money to bail us out. They were in Washington talking about the catastrophe that would happen to America if that didn't happen. They got the government to basically push the World Bank and the IMF to work on the areas where they had the most risk and they had the most interest in retrieving it. And then the 90s just compiled that with the Mexican peso crisis, where Clinton also worked with Robert Rubin to save Mexican interests for Goldman and other U.S. banks, and then the repeal of Glass-Steagall in 1999, and then all of this idea of consolidation of risk and power just exponentially grew from there.
Noemi Prinz, you talk about Goldman Sachs and that it wasn't always as powerful as it is today.
Yeah, Goldman Sachs almost died in 1928, basically between 1908 and 1929. They had a trading partnership in which investors invested money, and the stock of that trust went up to $320-something, and then it subsequently went down to one. And there were a lot of angry investors around the street and so forth. But a man named Sidney Weinberg, who was the chairman of Goldman at the time, who actually joined Goldman in the panic of 1907 as sort of an underling, decided that if he could befriend FDR in such a manner as to help him run his 1932 campaign, he would kind of have a seat at the table. And so the legitimacy of Goldman with respect to FDR also allowed FDR to create the first business council that Sidney Weinberg pushed in Washington to forge relationships between the business financial community in Washington and so on. Sidney Weinberg also was behind LBJ's choice of Henry Fowler as a Treasury Secretary, who then joined Goldman Sachs after being a Treasury Secretary. And, of course, we had Henry Paulson, who did the other way. Bush picked him to be the Treasury Secretary, George W. Bush. And then, of course, course, Clinton picked Robert Rubin, coming from Goldman Sachs, to be the Treasury Secretary in his administration. But it started with Sidney Weinberg and FDR.
We're going to break and then come back to this discussion. Then we're going to be speaking with the Vermont Congressman, Peter Welch. He wants to expose the budgets of the 16 intelligence agencies. When we come back, though, Nomi Prinz will talk about her favorite story in the book. She's the author of the new book, All the President's Bankers, The Hidden Alliances That Drive American Power. Stay with us. Mumbles, Clark Terry here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Maté. In a moment, we'll be speaking with Vermont Congressmember Peter Welch. But right now, we're continuing with Nomi Prinz, the author of All the President's Bankers. She's a former managing director at Bear Stearns and Goldman Sachs, and previously an analyst at Lehman Brothers and other places. But we want to go to a clip right now of President Obama. In 2009, 60 Minutes, he lashes out at what he calls the fat cat bankers of Wall Street.
I did not run for office to be helping out a bunch of fat cat bankers on Wall Street. The only ones that are going to be paying out these fat bonuses are the ones that have now paid back that TARP money. And
you think that's why they paid it back so quickly?
I think in some cases that was a motivation, which I think tells me that the people on Wall Street still don't get it. They don't get it. They're still puzzled. Why is it that people are mad at the banks? Well, let's see. You guys are drawing down $10, $20 million bonuses after America went through the worst economic year that it's gone through in decades. And you guys caused the problem. And we got 10% unemployment. Why do you think people might be a little frustrated?
That's President Obama speaking in 2009. I'm wondering if there's been any break in the symbiotic relationship between Wall Street and Washington that you document. Certainly, with Obama's second term, when he ran against Romney, his donations from Wall Street dropped. It was something like $16 million, went down to $6 million. So do you see any change of course in this pattern of symbiosis that you trace in your book?
Well, of course, Wall Street was very primary in getting him elected to begin with. And I think also Wall Street doesn't really particularly care who's in office. So there was a time during that campaign period where they just believed Romney had a better shot. It wasn't so much necessarily a negative on Obama. I think they were just playing their bet, and they happened to have lost, which they usually haven't over the many of elections. Who Wall Street backs tends to be who wins, but sometimes that backing gets a little bit split. But in that clip, and a lot of what Obama has said, what is said publicly and what actually happens inside the private office and with respect to what's going on with bankers, shows up in the reforms. It shows up in the structures. It shows up in the minions of lobbyists and lawyers that continue to funnel money and little chips away at even very weak but existing rules. And Obama has allowed that to happen. He's never come out and named a name against a banker. He talks about Wall Street fat cats as some sort of, like, big broad category. He's not named names. He's not said what Wall Street needs to done. It's just sort of fluffy rhetoric.
Would he even say what he said in 2009, talking about the fat cat bankers today?
No. You know why? Because he believes, or he says, I shouldn't say believes, I don't know, but that the 2010 Dodd-Frank Act was somehow sweeping reform, and he characterizes it as being relative to FDR's reform when he did the Glass-Steagall Act and the New Deal and created the SEC and all sorts of things. And it simply wasn't. As I mentioned before, banks got bigger. Their concentration of our deposits and assets and risk got bigger. Nothing was fixed by that, quote, Reform Act. And so he doesn't need to say that now. He said it kind of in the beginning to consolidate his base, to get elected, whatever it was. But many presidents, and actually Democrats are a little bit more guilty of this than Republicans, because I think they feel they need to do this, from Wilson on, have always bashed the bankers in their campaign speeches. And then when it comes right down to it, most of them have been very helpful and very symbiotic with them after they have been in office. So it tends to get said to the public. And then when you look at what actually occurred, it's a completely different matter because they are connected.
Well, Naomi Prinz, I want to thank you for being with us. All the President's Bankers is her book, The Hidden Alliances That Drive American Power. You can read an excerpt of that book on our website at democracynow.org. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Maté.
Well, we turn now to what's known as the black budget. That's the term for secret budgets of the nation's 16 intelligence agencies, including the NSA and CIA. Last year, the Washington Post used documents leaked by NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden to reveal the nation's black budget to be $53 billion. The Post reported the CIA had received a 56% increase in its budget over the past decade, while the NSA got a 54% hike. The black budget also revealed the NSA is paying hundreds of millions of dollars a year to telephone and internet companies for secret access to their communications networks.
Well, now a bipartisan push has begun on Capitol Hill to make parts of the black budget public. Democratic Congress member Peter Welch of Vermont and Republican Congresswoman Cynthia Lummis of Wyoming, both members of the House Oversight Committee on National Security, have co-written legislation to force the president to include the total dollar amount requested for each intelligence agency in his annual budget submission to Congress. The bill is called the Intelligence Budget Transparency Act. Congressmember Peter Welch joins us now from Capitol Hill. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Congressman. Can you talk about just what this act would make transparent?
Well, pretty basic information. How much of taxpayer money is being spent on intelligence gathering activities? The top line number. You know, there's not just the NSA and the CIA. We have like 17 different intelligence gathering agencies. And those budgets have exploded. They're up over 50%. Even as is pointed out, the National Institute of Health, that budget is down 22%. And if you are going to have any oversight whatsoever, you have to know what the budget is. And in fact, the 9/11 Commission advocated this. You know, somebody with solid credentials on national security, Lee Hamilton, is a strong proponent of letting the taxpayers know how much is being spent. You know, think about it. If you had 16 different government agencies administering the food stamp program on a secret budget, how would you know where they were stumbling into each other, where they were coordinating or not coordinating, where they were duplicating? So this is basic information that's the beginning of congressional oversight and accountability in the intelligence community.
And, Congressmember, you've also called for ending the gag order on private companies in terms of their role in disclosing private information. Can you detail that for us?
Well, sure. You know, these telephone companies, through the FISA court, have been being required to turn over information that their customers think was private. And they're under a gag order, so they can't disclose what the government is seeking. So what you have, essentially, with the expansion of the FISA court definition of what is acceptable for the intelligence agencies to do, is private companies with private information on you and me being required to turn that over in secret. So what we want to do is end the gag order. If AT&T or Verizon is requested to turn over information, they should be able to disclose that. So then there's an open and public debate about the limits on intelligence gathering.
I want to turn to a clip right now. This is a comment that was made during a recent TED Talk by the Deputy Director of National Security Agency, Richard Leggett, who said Congress had authorized the NSA's various programs.
It's important to note that the programs that we're talking about were all authorized by two different presidents, two different political parties, by Congress twice, and by federal judges 16 different times. And so it's not this is not NSA running off and doing its own things. This is a legitimate activity of the United States foreign government that was agreed to by all the branches of the United States government, and President Madison would have been proud.
And yet, when congressmen discovered what was actually being done with that authorization, many of them were completely shocked. Or do you think that is not a legitimate reaction, that it's only because it's now come out publicly that they really knew exactly what you were doing with the powers they had granted you?
So I think Congress is a big body. There's 535 of them. And they change out frequently, in the case of the House, every 2 years. And I think that NSA provided all the relevant information to our oversight committees. And then the dissemination of that information by the oversight committees throughout Congress is something that that they manage. I think I would say that Congress members had the opportunity to make themselves aware. And in fact, a significant number of them, the ones who are assigned oversight responsibility, did have visibility to that. And you've actually had the chairs of those committees say that in public.
That is the deputy director of the NSA, Richard Leggett, talking about Congress authorizing what the NSA has done. Congressmember Welch, would you agree with what he's saying?
Well, you know, it's idiotic what he just said. It's extraordinarily disrespectful of the Constitution and extraordinarily disrespectful of the privacy rights of the American citizens. Here's why. Jim Sensenbrenner was a conservative Republican who helped write the law. And he's appalled by the overreach of the intelligence gathering agencies in the NSA. And here's why. There was in the law the right to go to the FISA court on the basis of reasonable suspicion to examine, let's say, my phone records. There was some articulable suspicion that passed the judgment test of a judge in FISA, and you could get my records. What NSA has done is said that they can get everybody's, all Americans' emails, text, and telephone messages, all of them, just on the basis of the law and its authorization. That is, like, so overbroad and so disrespectful that there's no end to what they can do. The second point is that it may be that some of the Intelligence Committee members had access to this information, but the American people didn't have access to this information, that there was this new NSA policy, which was essentially authorizing a dragnet of all of our emails and telephone records. So that's just, I think, an incredible self-serving stretch that shows an appalling disrespect to the Constitution and the reasonable limits that have to be part of a balance of security and privacy.
And Congressmember, you've written a letter to President Obama, co-authored by Lee Hamilton. So you have some bipartisan action on this. How important is it to you, and how significant is it to you, that you've gotten Republicans to join you in this call for transparency?
It's incredibly important. We're not going to get important things done here unless there's people on both sides. And what this reflects, Cynthia Lummis is a solid person who's got a lot of pretty hard Tea Party credentials. She cares about the Constitution. She cares about privacy rights. She cares about security. And in our coalition, you're seeing left to right who all say there's got to be security, but we've got to protect the constitutional rights of the American citizens. The second thing is that all of us know you just can't give a blank check to any agency. You know, the intelligence gathering agencies obviously had an opportunity and necessary to get more money after 9/11. But at a certain point, you've got to step back and kick the tires. Are they doing a good job? Are they duplicating? Are they getting value for the money that the taxpayers are giving them? They are not immune to oversight just because they're doing something that's important, any more than any other governmental agency has been. By the way, you know, the intelligence gathering agencies have blown it on a lot of occasions. It's not as though the fact that they do important work means that they always do it well. They got it wrong on weapons of mass destruction. They were involved in toppling democratically elected leaders like in Guatemala and even in Iran. I mean, this is not an organization that has 20/20 vision most of the time.
Congressmember Welch, do you believe that Edward Snowden should be allowed back into the United States and should not be charged with treason, as the White House is pushing for, though we know there's a debate inside the White House?
Well, it's a pretty tough call. A lot of the information that Mr. Snowden revealed is information I believe that we should have had. Like, for instance, on this Dragnet surveillance. The American people, that should have been disclosed to us, because that's a policy debate. So in that sense, getting that information out, I am glad that we know that. On the other hand, the indications are that there was an enormous data dump by Mr. Snowden that may include things that we have no business knowing. And I just don't know what the story is on the full picture. So I'm undecided on that.
Do you believe he's a whistleblower?
Well, the definition of whistleblower is you're disclosing some information that the public has a right to know. So my view on the aspect of it where there was this wholesale dragnet of our information, that sort of fits into that category. Some of the other information that he's disclosed may be state secrets, that I don't know, and that could be in a different category. So I'm not sure it's a one-size-fits-all with Mr. Snowden.
Congressmember, on Monday, the Supreme Court declined to hear the case that challenged bulk surveillance, an appeal of the ruling back from last year that basically called bulk collection almost Orwellian. Your stance on this program and where you think this goes now that it goes back to the appeals court?
Well, I think it is almost Orwellian. I mean, there's two things about it. Number one, getting all of our information in the hands of a governmental agency where we have no idea how it's going to be used. History suggests that absolute power corrupts, and we can anticipate that somewhere, sometime, some president, Nixon or whoever, is going to abuse that information. So I do have a real objection to it. Secondly, I think it really interferes with good intelligence gathering because it becomes like an agency that is getting so much information. In effect, it's creating haystacks in order to search for needles. The hard work of intelligence has to be to follow the leads, to develop them, and not just to have access to all information on everybody in the world when you don't have an identifiable target that you're following, a trail that you're or a leads that you're following.
Congressmember Welch, since it's the first time we've had you on, and you've been a pioneer in many different areas, in these last few minutes, we'd like to ask you questions on a few different issues. For example, Governor Shumlin devoted his whole State of the Union address to the issue of the heroin crisis in Vermont, and that has led to national coverage of this issue, specifically in Vermont and all over. You had the New York Times front page pieces. Now you have this Rolling Stone piece. That has, I know it's controversial in Vermont, the picture of beloved Vermont maple syrup, but it says heroin on it. Can you talk about what you feel needs to be done about this crisis that's not in Vermont alone, of course, but is ripping through your state?
Well, it's a real issue in all across America, but particularly rural America. It was interesting because the governor made a very bold decision. And a lot of my colleagues said to me when I got down here, that on one hand, how does that hurt how does that affect the reputation of your state? And the second thing they said is, you know, what he talked about, we have that in my state, in my district. And what actually has happened is he's brought out into the sunlight what a lot of our law enforcement officers, what a lot of our healthcare workers on the front line have been vividly aware of. And what I think is the most important part of this is that the law enforcement community in Vermont, and I think this is probably true a lot of other places, they have come to the forefront and provided leadership saying you can't arrest your way out of this. So there's got to be a significant focus on treatment. That's number one. Number two, the fact that it's a public issue now, I think gives immense relief to parents who are terrified about some of their kids that are getting in trouble. It's also in our healthcare community, putting an emphasis on what some of the real hazards are of overprescription of pain medication that hooks people and gets them into this dependency. So the public discussion in the focus on treatment, particularly for a lot of the folks who are the victim end of this, not the dealers, not the sellers, you know, throw the book at those folks. I think that's been very helpful. And everything you've seen is that Governor Shumlin, in talking about Vermont, hit a chord because a lot of our rural communities are being afflicted with this.
On the issue of drugs, Congressmember, you've also been a leader in calling for, first of all, repealing subsidies to drug companies and also for negotiating lower drug prices. Can you talk about your efforts around the issue of pharmaceuticals?
Well, you know, that's the exploding cost to healthcare. You know, we need good pharmaceuticals, and we need a research budget in order for them to do it. But if we have pharmaceuticals, like this last drug that came out from one company that's promising, but it's $80,000 a year, then you're going to make it impossible for people who need it to afford it. Also, if you're just going to kind of cram these huge profit-driven explosive prices on the taxpayer, it's going to bury Medicare and Medicaid. You know, in the VA, they have price negotiations. In the Medicare program, Congress, thanks to Tom DeLay, made it illegal to bulk price and negotiate when you're buying drugs. VA, oftentimes the same drug will cost 50, 60, 70% less than what it'll cost through Medicare. Canada negotiates price discounts. So this is billions and billions of dollars that we could save, in my view, without adversely affecting the bottom line of a lot of these pharmaceutical companies that are doing good work, but putting the squeeze on the taxpayer and on the employers and individuals who are paying premiums.
Now, your body, the House of Representatives, last week voted, passed a legislation that would effectively force government agencies to stop studying climate change, calling on the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and related bodies to focus on forecasting severe weather, but not exploring the likely cause. Now, Vermont is a case study of the effects of climate change. You were devastated by Hurricane Irene. Talk about what you feel, as a person who has championed the issue of renewable energy, needs to be done now. And how did that get passed?
Well, you may have noticed that science does not exist on Capitol Hill. We're in a fact-free zone here on some issues. And when it comes to climate change, people kind of make it up as they go along. In passing a law that prohibits you from getting information that you need in order to make decisions is pretty upside down and bizarre. But that's the world we're in. In Vermont, on the climate change issue, here's the key. If we take on the challenge of climate change rather than ignore it, it's not only going to be good for the environment, it's actually going to create jobs. And this is the one area where there's some bipartisan hope in Congress. You know, I don't win any arguments. I'm not going to persuade any of my colleagues who don't believe in the science of climate change that it exists. But a lot of my colleagues do agree on efficiency, that if you can use less fuel, whatever the fuel source, you're going to save money, you're going to create jobs, like in retrofitting homes and buildings. So that's a promising area where we can do something good for the environment and also build the economy. But the real dilemma here is that the folks who are so against climate change as a challenge that we have to face, I think the possibility that in taking on that challenge we can create a strong economy eludes them. And that's what we have to do, because the middle class is getting squeezed. They need jobs, and we've got to find ways through building our infrastructure and having a stronger energy policy that can help create jobs and increase wages.
Finally, I know you have to go, but President Obama has pushed for a nuclear renaissance. Very unusual. You come from a state, Vermont. In fact, you were the Senate president dealing with your nuclear power plant, one of the few in the country that were shut down. Here we are in the wake of Fukushima, third anniversary. What are your thoughts about nuclear power and the fact that these plants are being built in Georgia for the first time in more than 30 years? Do you think nuclear power is the answer to the issue of climate change?
I don't. And here's why. There's enormous economic obstacles, aside from the safety issues, aside from the fact that we still don't know what to do with the nuclear waste. The amount of subsidies that the taxpayer has to provide in order to get those plants built, the loan guarantees that have to be provided, and then the so-called standby agreements, where if there's a delay in permitting, the expense of that delay is passed on to the taxpayer, is just a monstrous bill that makes them economically, I think, unjustifiable. The second thing is that with the lower cost of gas, natural gas, that's really having an adverse impact on the market power of these nuclear generators. And that was a major reason why the plant in Vermont is being closed, is that the Entergy, the owner, came to the conclusion that it wasn't economically feasible to keep it going, even though they actually had a shot at doing that. So I think the economics of nuclear power, not just the safety issues, make it unlikely that it's going to be the path forward.
Congressmember Peter Welch, thanks so much for being with us, the lone Democratic congressmember from Vermont, speaking to us from Capitol Hill, co-sponsor of the Intelligence Budget Transparency Act that would shine a spotlight on the 16 budgets of the intelligence agencies of the United States. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, a major ruling on Americans killed in drone strikes in Yemen. Stay with us. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Maté.
Well, a federal judge has dismissed a lawsuit challenging the government's killings of three Americans in Yemen by drone strikes. The families of Muslim cleric Anwar al-Awlaki, his teenage son Abdul al-Rahman, and of Samir Khan had filed the suit accusing top officials of unlawful killings. But on Friday, District Court Judge Rosemary Collier ruled the victims' constitutional rights were never violated and said the officials involved can't be held liable.
Despite that ruling, Judge Collier also added, quote, "The powers granted to the executive and Congress to wage war and provide for national security does not give them carte blanche to deprive a U.S. citizen of his life without due process and without any judicial review." Well, for more, we're joined by Maria LaHood, senior staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, one of the attorneys working on Anwar al-Awlaki's case. Welcome to Democracy Now! We just have a few minutes, but explain the significance of Judge Collier's ruling.
Well, the court essentially—I mean, we rely on the courts to uphold our rights under the Constitution, especially our right to due process, not to be killed. And essentially, she did give the executive carte blanche to kill anyone it deems to be a terrorist suspect, far from any battlefield, with no due process, even if they don't really even if they don't pose an imminent threat. So it's not only, you know, she said that we don't give the courts carte blanche, she doesn't give the executive carte blanche, but in fact, she decided, she refused to allow a claim in the area of national security, even for a violation of the Constitution, even for a killing of an American citizen.
With this ruling, are there any more legal challenges to pursue in order to obtain the right to due process?
Well, I mean, this is, you know, there have been—the courts have abdicated their roles with torture. They've abdicated their roles with indefinite detention. Here we thought, you know, finally the courts would uphold the Constitution with the killing of American citizens. The victims' families have been through an extraordinary amount. They have suffered an unimaginable loss, having their sons and their grandson.
Abdul Rahman was 16 years old, born in Denver.
You know, gruesomely killed by their own government. The families have undergone the pain of having their names maligned publicly, and having, you know, the injustice of having the court slam the door in their face.
Who did you sue?
We sued Panetta, Petraeus.
And explain their positions.
Well, we have the Secretary of Defense, the CIA director. We also sued other members of the military, the JSOC director, as well as the Special Ops Command director.
The court said that government officials must be trusted when they target U.S. citizens abroad?
Must be trusted, yes. You know, this is outrageous, obviously. They can't be trusted with anything. You know, there's no transparency. We have no idea who they're killing, why they're killing people. There are no legal standards that have been publicly released. They've disclosed a few about U.S. citizens not in active hostilities, but they refuse to disclose the memos, the classified memos. So we know that U.S. officials can't be trusted with this authority.
Where does this go from here? What are the implications of this for other cases? And are government officials like these and higher up being sued in other cases?
There are no suits that I know of for accountability like this. There are suits for transparency, to get information about what the government is doing. But of course, that's the first step, I think, in accountability. But no other cases for accountability that I know of. I think it's up to, you know, I think it's not only up to the victims of these strikes to demand investigations and accountability and redress, but it's also up to all of us to demand that as well, not necessarily just in the courts, but in the streets.
You can see all of our coverage of the cases of Samir Khan and the Awlakis at democracynow.org. Maria Lahoud, I want to thank you very much for being with us, staff attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights. That does it for the show. Our website is democracynow.org. You can see the transcript, read the video. You can watch the video, listen to the audio podcasts of all of our shows. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkner, Nathal Saramate, Naomi Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Akoff, Hani Masood, Rabbi Karen, Dina Guzdari, Amy Littlefield. I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Mate for another edition of Democracy Now!